Football O'Clock.
He's at the 30. He's at the 20. He won't give it up. Oh, God. No. 2 seconds on the clock.
Football O'Clock.
Es ist Zeit. Es ist Zeit für American Football. Es ist Zeit für Win Today Football O'Clock. Und das Ganze erstmals im neuen Jahr mit einer großen Überraschung, einem großen Gast auch im Gepäck. Aber wie immer freut es mich an dieser Stelle zuerst Österreichs American Football Aushängeschild, Tight End in Diensten der Arizona Cardinals, Bernhard Zeikowitz begrüßen zu dürfen. Bernhard, schön, dich in der Win Today Football O'Clock Leitung zu haben und erst einmal frohes neues Jahr.
Ja, servus, freut mich auch. Frohes Neues an alle daheim. Wir waren ein bisschen später, aber jetzt sind wir auch rübergerutscht. Ja, frohes Neues.
Wie hast du den Jahreswechsel verbracht?
Mit Familie, meine Cousine ist gerade da. Das heißt, wir haben das Cardinals-Spiel geschaut und dann waren wir noch in der Stadt, haben ein Basketballspiel geschaut und dann sind wir eigentlich ganz entspannt ins neue Jahr gerutscht.
Das hört sich doch sehr, sehr toll an. Noch toller ist, dass wir an dieser Stelle erstmals dauerhaft über die komplette Folge Zuwachs haben. Es ist niemand geringer als Jelle Froholt, der mit uns diese Folge bestreiten wird. Cardinals Offensive Lineman Starting Center. Und wie immer ist diese Folge dreigeteilt. Wir sprechen erst über den grandiosen Sieg der Arizona Cardinals am vergangenen Sonntag gegen die Philadelphia Eagles. Wir sprechen dann im Thema der Woche über Internationalität in der NFL und danach reden wir wie immer über die wichtigsten News rund um die NFL. Bernhard, bist du bereit?
Ich bin bereit.
Wir beginnen wie immer mit unseren
Arizona Cardinals.
This is really great. I've been looking forward to this for a very long time. Basically, back a couple of weeks ago when we started about the possibility of having him on. He's the veteran offensive lineman. He's the center, starting center for the Arizona Cardinals. He's Jelde Froholt. I'm trying to get the hang of the pronunciation, but Jelde, so glad that you're joining Bernhard and me here on Win Today Football O'Clock.
No, thanks for having me, guys. This is awesome. I'm excited.
Yeah, I have to start with you. How big was that W yesterday?
It was awesome. Definitely. I mean, since it's been a tough season. I mean, I know Psycho can say that too. Like it's been brutal to say the least. But you know, we keep chugging along, and practice is still hard, and we still get after it. And you know, we don't really always get the outcome we want, but then to go into Philly and beat the heck out of them, that was awesome. And especially the fashion we did it, right, with 30 seconds left or whatever it was, scored a go-ahead touchdown. It was awesome.
It's a 35-31 victory for the Arizona Cardinals. And Bernhard, the interesting thing is you had to talk about so many losses. And of course, right around when we wanted to bring Jelde on, the Cardinals do secure a W. Is he going to be the lucky charm of this podcast? And does he need to be back next week if there is another win, just in case?
Maybe so. Maybe the podcast is the lucky charm, but yeah, maybe.
I love to.
Bernhard, the one question that a lot of people asked was if this game, or if you got the feeling during the week that this game meant a little more for Jonathan Gannon. Obviously, with his past as a defensive coordinator for the Philadelphia Eagles, maybe showing them what they kind of lost in not letting him go. I mean, everybody lets you go if you want to go on and become a head coach. But did you get the feeling that this meant a little more to him, or did he keep it even keel in preps and in all the meetings, and did he handle it just as, quote-unquote, another game?
I mean, the way he was talking about it in meetings and stuff, he definitely wanted it to be just a regular week, just another week for us. I'm sure maybe on the inside of him, he wanted to have this win more than others. But at least from my perspective, it felt like a regular week. And the only thing that really was different is that he was really comfortable in his plan. And, since he knew so much about the other team, and he was really comfortable in what we had going in the week, and and it worked out for us, so that was good.
Jelle, how did you prepare for this Eagles game? And I sent along kind of a little preparation for this talk, and I labeled it very consciously the previously feared Eagles front. Only one sack that your unit allowed, I think only three tackles for loss, a mightily impressive job against this squad that featured Cox and Carter and Sweats and Graham. How did you prepare for them?
And I was the only guy that gave up that freaking sack, so that kind of sucks. But I think it's, you know, they do have a really good D-line, but I do think that, like, we, like, just like Psycho said, we kind of walked into it with the same mentality. I mean, we're playing in a league right now with just good D-linemen all over the place. Like, especially we face the 49ers twice a year, and it's a mess to play against those guys. So I think, you know, we headed into it saying, all right, we know where their holes are. We know we're going to try to out-scheme them. And we kind of had a good idea where they're going to line up most of the time. And then, just like Zagro said too, the same thing happened with our offensive coordinator. I feel like he was super comfortable with, like, when they give us this, when we're in 11 personnel, this is what we're going to run. When they give us this, when we're 12 personnel, this is what we're going to run. And it was kind of cool to be able to, like, just head in there and feel super confident. Like, these are the runs we run against these fronts. And then we just executed and just played super hard. So I know they've had some issues at their secondary and their linebacker core as well. So obviously, you know, that's whenever you lose your starters, it's always a big, you know, chip in it, in the armor there. But we walked into the game with the same mentality as we have all year, because I feel like every week we just face another, like, daunting D-line. So, it was definitely good to go in there and honestly beat their ass.
Let's just stick with the victory and how it all came about, and just also talk about the character of the team. You were down 3-14. You were down 6-21, and you still clawed your way back into the game. What does it say about this current Cardinals squad that there's no giving up?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, that's kind of been the MO all year, and just those super close games, we just haven't been able to really get the last play or get the last drive or just push through that last, like, you know, the last thing. But, you know, I thought even heading into halftime, I felt really good. You know, we had a couple of miscues in that first half. We went down the red zone three times, got 6 points off of it, and the interception went for a touchdown. But we had, 41 plays in the first half, over almost 200 yards of offense. So, you know, we headed into the second half with, like, a lot of confidence. Like, hey, we can do this, man. And then we walked straight out there, got a touchdown, got the ball back, scored again, and all of a sudden it's tied. I think it's just – that's just kind of mentality of this, like, this team. You know, they just don't give up, and you feel that in the facility as well as at practice.
Bennett, you had the unfortunate task in the past of talking about so many different losses, so many different close losses, where you said, well, if one or two plays had gone the other way, we could have walked away with the win. Was this the best all-around game, even though the Cardinals conceded 31 points to the Eagles? But still, was this the best all-around effort of the year?
Probably yes. If not, then probably pretty close to it. I would say just how dominant, at least on the offensive side, how dominant we were in the game. I think later in the game, they showed a stat about time of possession, and we had close to 40 minutes and they had around 20. So just how dominant the offense was on the field, how much we controlled the game. And just like Fro said, in the first half, we just couldn't score touchdowns, and but we were walking up and down the field however we wanted to. So I think it was, from the offensive side, it was really a dominant performance.
Yeah, could you take us into the locker room during halftime? I mentioned the score and that you were down. Was it just a quote-unquote normal halftime, or were there things being said, being done that helped helped you kind of complete that comeback?
Well, first of all, I was dead tired after those 41 plays in the first half. So I don't know. I consumed a lot of caffeine and a lot of pre-workout. But I think, you know, that there was a lot of juice going in there. You know, like our offensive coordinator came down, Drew, and it was like, guys, we're freaking moving the ball. And we're going to continue to move the ball. And it was good to feel that, like, he didn't veer off track. Like, we didn't start panic and start throwing the ball constantly. No, we did the same thing we knew we were going to do, and we stuck to our game plan. We ended up running the ball, what, like 40 times? Mm-hmm. And it's just like, that's when we're good, when we're just sticking to it and we don't, like, because we were down with 21-6, but it was the same thing against, you know, Chicago. We were down 21-0, and it was almost like we just couldn't really get back. But we stuck to our plan, and we're like, there's a lot of game left. Let's finish this out. And then defense came up with a couple of good stops, and then all of a sudden you're back in it. So, I mean, there was a lot of juice and a lot of energy in halftime, and it was good to feel.
Of course, Bernard was right with his assessment in terms of time of possession. 39 minutes, 39 seconds, the Cardinals had the ball. How's the offensive line room behaving when the offensive coordinator comes down during halftime and tells you guys, you know what, let's run the ball down their throats? Is that something that you as a group embrace, or you personally embrace?
I mean, 100%. I think it's just that, like, I think when you then get to halftime and he does say that, you feel the pressure of like, all right, well, we have to be able to block it now. Because if he tries to run the ball a couple of times and we get stuffed, then he doesn't feel comfortable running it again. And I don't blame him. Like, it's like, oh, okay, well, then let's run these three plays that are premier running plays, and we don't get any yardage. Well, then he's like, well, I don't really feel comfortable running anymore. So, there's a lot of pressure on our shoulders to then do it. And I mean, like, it takes everybody. It's not just the O-line. It's also the tight ends, the freaking receivers. The receivers are blocking their asses off too. You saw them push crack constantly and get in the secondary and all that. But it's definitely a confidence booster as well.
Penna, we talked here on Win Today Football Clock about James Conner and everything there is about him. But after yesterday's effort, might he be one of the most underappreciated skill position players in the league, if not the most underappreciated one?
Yeah, I guess. I guess you can say so, yes. I mean, for us, James, like the people in our building, we know who James is and what he brings to the table. And we are really glad and happy that he's on our team, because he just works his ass off week in and week out. And there's never any, like, you know, he's just always going at the same pace, and no matter what, if we won or if we lost, or if he's feeling good or bad, you just get James Conner every day, and that's why everybody respects him and appreciates him. And yeah, on the football field, if he gets a chance, I remember a couple games back we lost, and then we were like, yeah, well, James didn't touch the ball enough. And then the next game we gave him the ball, and then we won. So whenever he touches the ball, good things happen for us. And yeah.
You as a fellow pass catcher, Bernard, when you see him catch a pass like the 100 that he snagged out of the air, what goes through your mind there?
Yeah, that's just nice. I mean, every time you're able to catch the ball with two hands, you probably choose to catch him with two, because it's just safer. But yeah, he just caught it with one hand, and yeah, great play.
Yeah, to take us inside of that moment with 32 seconds left, you're at the goal line. You're about to suck all the air out of Lincoln Financial Field. How do you remember that sequence of James Conner getting into the end zone and you securing the game-winning points there?
I don't know. I think I just, at that point in the game, there was just so much confidence. Like, it was like, we're going to win. Like, this is it. Like, I don't care what's going to happen. Even on that play, like, because I think we had like two timeouts left. It was second and two or whatever on the 2 yard line. We're just like, if this doesn't go in, we're going to score like 100%. Like, it does not matter. Like, we just felt extremely confident. And you could feel in the huddle too. Everybody knew that, like, we're going to go win this game right now. You can feel it from K1, you can feel it from Connor, you can feel it from all the receivers that was in there. The whole O-line was just like, this is happening. I don't care what happens next, but we're going to score. So that was a good feeling to feel like the confidence level from everybody in that huddle was like at an all-time high, and everybody just knew like, this is it. So that was really awesome to, you know, experience and kind of be like, this is the best we've actually performed as a unit this entire year, at least in the second half. You know, we had a miscues in the first half, but in the second half, like the whole game, we just, you know, we're running up and down the field.
You secured some big W's this year, but this one's probably right up there, and it happened during or at an away game, and it happened on New Year's Eve. How was that trip back to Arizona?
It was awesome, man. Well, I mean, right when we got to the plane, it was like awesome, but then when you're 3 hours in, there's still an hour and a half left in that plane, you're like, god damn, dude. But it was a good time. You know, everybody was in a good mood. You know, everybody kind of walked around the cabin and, you know, we're talking and communicating and having a good time. So it's nice to have those long trips or to win before those long trips, because it makes them a little bit easier and a little bit more relaxed and fun. And, you know, people are a little bit more loose instead of like, dang it, we lost another one. So that was awesome.
You guys already were in meetings today. There's only one game left to be played for the Arizona Cardinals of 2023, even though it's going to happen in 2024. It's against the Seattle Seahawks, division rival, as is always the case with the last regular season game. It's the Seattle Seahawks coming to town. Donald, from everything that you can tell right now, how much would it mean for the Cardinals to spoil or play spoiler to Seattle's playoff hopes?
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Fro, but I feel like we don't see it that way, and we just approach every opponent the same, I guess. And just, you know, if we get the W, that's what matters for us. Obviously we're not in the playoff race anymore, but yeah, I don't think we want to win to you know, have something bad for the other team. I just think we want the W.
Yeah, I mean, I think like our motivation is not to spoil anybody's season. That's not like the motivation. Maybe it's in like in college, it's like, oh yeah, make them get a bad bowl game or whatever, but it's like now it's just the motivation is to win. The motivation is like for all of us to just be better, and I think that's what you can feel in the entire facility, which is super awesome.
That indeed sounds like a plan, and I guess we'll find out next week around this time if you succeeded at that task.
Yeah.
As is the case, whenever two Austrians and a Danish guy are talking about American football, there is an international component to it, especially when one Austrian and one Danish guy are indeed NFL players, which kind of brings us to our topic of the week. We want to talk about international players in the NFL, we want to talk about international play, international expansion, and everything that goes into it. We'll do it right now. Again, pleased to have him here next side to Bernard Zajkowicz. And Bernard, we talked so many times about you being an international player, you making your way from Austria to the NFL. Same goes for Jelde Froholt, and I think I mispronounced your name in the first part, and I was sure this was gonna happen. So apologies for that. It's probably not the most common name around here in Austria, but yet for every international born player, it's a huge accomplishment to make it to the National Football League. And when you got there, when you first set foot onto NFL turf for a regular season game, do you still remember what went through your head back then?
Honestly, not. I think it's all been so long ago. I mean, it was like my second year. I was coming back from injury, and it was during COVID, and a lot of stuff was going on. You know, I think like there are a couple moments that you cherish and you think about and you remember, but overall it's like I think one thing that I've realized is that, like, is the journey that with the boys that you're with and everything that you kind of go through and fight through together. I think that's what I remember more. Like, I remember the guys in the room or some of the practices, walking off practice and you're laughing and joking and stuff like that or whatever. Yeah, some of those first years are a little blurry right now because I think, you know, I didn't see the field much. I got cut. I moved to different teams and stuff like that. So the past 2 years are a little bit more vivid in my mind. but definitely, I mean, going out there and suiting up and, like, really letting yourself get the chance, like, holy shit, like, I'm standing on the line, like, I'm about to play a football game in National Football League, and I'm being paid to do this. It's definitely a privilege and also something that, you know, I'm really grateful for.
We'll eventually get to all these kind of components that you mention, or hopefully some of them. But Bernard, you as a fellow international player, is there a lowest common denominator of things did you have in common with someone who grew up in Denmark and started playing football there, someone who grew up in Germany and started playing American football there, someone who grew up in Mexico and started playing American football there? Is there something that ties you all together?
I think so, yeah. I think the first time I saw Ferro was in OTAs, or, like, even before OTAs, just in workouts. And it was really a surprise because I didn't know him. I didn't know about his story or anything. So it was a surprise to me that, like, he's not from here, but he's playing in the league. And even though he went a little different path than I did, it's, I guess, refreshing, or I don't know. It's just interesting to see other people from outside of the US in the league you play in. So yeah, I would say there's for sure something, because every international player didn't go the regular route. We had to leave families and you know, all that. So I think there's for sure stuff that ties us together a little bit.
Hjalte, if you allow, let us be part of your journey and tell us a little bit how you made your way from Svendborg, Denmark, onto the National Football League.
Yeah, I mean, I think what Psycho kind of hits on there is it's funny with, like, whenever you meet an international player, because I mean, every player in the NFL has an interesting story when you really get down to it, like how whatever happened in their past, if they've gone through some hard times and all that. But I do believe there's also a caveat to being an international player is that, like, it's such a weird process, because, like, I was lucky enough to be able to go to high school as an exchange student and play on a good team and be seen because there's other D1 athletes on my team. And then I played well enough to get some scholarships. So, like, for me, I might have had one of the more, like, quote unquote, I guess, like, regular ways to get to the NFL. Still tough, because, you know, you're on your own. You don't have family. It's not just like a 1 hour time change. It's like 6 hours if you're on the East Coast, or now it's like 8. So it's not as easy to communicate. So I think sometimes it's like you bundle things up and stuff like, so it's hard to deal with a lot of these things without having to be open about it. I was lucky enough to go to high school, got recruited, went to college, switch positions, because also sometimes international players, they're like, hey, you're actually not doing this very well, let's try something else, because you work really hard and you never really quit. Because I think that might be the common denominator between a lot of internationals, because we're like, if this doesn't work out, like, I'm probably gonna go home, so whatever I do now, it has to work. So I'm willing to, I mean, if they told Psycho to become a kicker, I'm sure Psycho would be like, bet, I'll do it, man, whatever it fucking takes. You know, like, so I think that's definitely one thing that whenever I talk to guys that's been around the Nationals, it's just like that, like, all or nothing mentality. And that, like, every day I walk in this facility, I'm going to give everything I have, and I'm going to work hard, I'm going to practice hard, and I'm not going to be apologetic about it. So I was lucky enough to have more of a calmer path compared to international pathway. Like, my previous teammate, Jakob, he went back home and worked at a factory back home, and then all of a sudden he entered their pathway, and then he was not even supposed to make the team, but then he just got way better And then he got hurt, whatever, but he's doing good now, yada, yada. It's like, it's such a, you know, unknown, which is really hard to deal with a lot of the time.
How often has it occurred to you both, and you already hit a little on it, Jelle, that once you're a European in the US, a lot of people go like, "Oh, you want to play American football? You're from Europe. I guess you'll be able to kick the ball, right?" How often did it try to make you a kicker?
I mean, I did punt. I punted from my high school team.
Yeah, I was a kicker back home too, but over here, I don't think I got asked once to kick. I got a lot of friends though that think they could easily kick in the NFL.
Oh,
nope, not that easy.
No,
I love that. I love these idiots all think that they can go in an NFL team and just kick it. They're like, "Yeah, man, I play soccer back home, and yeah, I could easily kick a ball 60 yards." Yeah, right.
Yeah,
there's Brandon Aubrey right now. So, what do we know?
True. Yes, yes. One time, I took a friend who, like, really believes he can kick. And I took him to a park, and then he was surprised that he couldn't kick it further, like 30 yards, 40 yards. It was like, damn,
this is actually hard.
It very much indeed is so. But better when we stick with the topic of the international players in the National Football League, and this is kind of a common thread on this podcast, and we've been talking about it during various instances. There's going to be, like, first and foremost, every year there are new and more international players. Next year there'll be an international player per team with the International Player Pathway program. But what do you think could the NFL do better, or is there anything they could do more to ensure that the pipeline kind of keeps growing?
I think the biggest thing is just, like, when you look at soccer, what the FIFA does to the sport, for the sport, they just spend so much money in, like, youth development or, like, just opportunities for kids to play the sport. And I think if the NFL really wants to have more people play the sport and get better talent from all around the world, they just have to spend some money to open opportunities for people outside of the US to play the sport. Because, like, over here, if you go to school, everything is paid for, at least in high school. Like, you don't have to pay for your cleats or maybe the cleats, I don't know, but you get your helmet and the shoulder pads and stuff like that. So it's easy to, like, kind of, hey, let me try football, maybe I like it. But back home, it's actually a big investment to, like, start playing football. I remember my mom, when she bought me my first pads and helmets, and she was like, "You're not quitting this, like, hobby. Like, you have to play now, because I just spent so much money on this." So yeah, I think that'd be really important. And then also, like Fro probably can talk more about this, but I have a couple friends who did, like, an exchange year just like Fro, and all of them, like, it's really blurry sometimes, like, to, as he said, pick a good school, because some people went over there and then the football program wasn't what they expected, and it was basically a waste of a year. So just make this, like, transition, like, coming from Europe as a young kid who wants to play football over there, easier, or, like, the resources just have to be better, I think.
Yeah, you immediately started laughing when Bernard was mentioning, or when he was mentioning, his mom and the cost of the equipment. Why?
Well, it's just because, like, I mean, the same, like, yeah, when we're back home, like, we bought a helmet. I remember my first, like, my own helmet was, like, a Shutt helmet. And it cost, like, $250 or something. And it's like, and that's just without the face mask. And you got to get the face mask with it. And they were just like, "You sure you don't want to just get some, like, shin protectors and some cleats and go play soccer? Like, are you sure about that? Like, you really need these helmets and $200 pads? And you also need pants with pads in them and specific cleats for running football? Like, this is ridiculous." So it's like, it was just funny how, like, it was it's such a big investment, because like some clubs back home in Denmark do have, they probably have some equipment, but it's like, I remember my first practice, my equipment was way too big and like a weird helmet. It's like, that's not safe. I'm sure it's gotten a lot better since I've been young, but because there's a little bit more traction going on with it, but still, like, it was, hey, you buy these shoulder pads, like, you better freaking play this damn game right now, man. You can't quit. At least give it like 2-3 years. Like, you can't quit now. Yeah.
I'm glad you're mentioning experiences from years past in Denmark, and that brings me to something that we kind of forgot, or that I kind of forgot to set the stage and give listeners back home an impression of American football in Denmark. What's the status quo of American football in Denmark? Is it growing? Is it getting more popular? I mean, with you as an ambassador for Denmark in the National Football League, it would just seem natural that there is growth for the sport. Is that the case?
I mean, I don't know the specific numbers. I do believe that the sport is growing. I know that there's one of the boarding schools, I forget what it's called, but like eighth or ninth grade, you can go to like a boarding school and you can either do like music or whatever and kind of leave home, but it's like 30 minutes away. They've made like a football line, actually in my hometown. So I do believe that it's getting better, but, I do know that like the clubs that are there, the love for football is like so intense, which is awesome to see. Like, my first team was Svendborg Admirals, and I was lucky enough to have a coach that just loved football, and he made it so much fun. Like, every practice was fun, every game was fun. He'd be like Andy Reid out there making these crazy trick plays and all kinds of stuff, and it was working. And it was like, that's my first memory of football. I was like, I loved playing football. Like, it was just always fun to me. Of course, when it rained and it was hailing, it was like, that's not super fun, but it was like overall a good experience. And I think that's something that at least the guys that are heading into football, it's like, we want to continue that development. So I do believe it's getting, you know, more attention, and there's more players that want to play. And I've had a countless amount of kids reaching out to me and saying like, what I need to do, this is my dream. It's like, I didn't know this was anybody's dream. Like, it's such a far reach dream. Even for me, when I began, like, I went to, as an exchange student, like Psycho said, it was like you could flip a coin and you don't know if you're landing in like a good school or a bad school, because you didn't really get to choose. So it's like, I was lucky enough to land in a good spot, but my aspirations wasn't, of course it'd be cool to go to college, but it was more like, hey, I just want to like play some football and get better and then go home and then kind of beat all my buddies. Like, that was kind of my idea. But definitely football has definitely gotten way bigger in Denmark. I assume, at least what I can see, but it's still, you know, an ever growing, like, keep pushing it, making sure like kids are engaged, and not reaching for other sports, such as like soccer or handball.
As with Austria, I guess American football, or those two countries, Denmark and Austria, were on the NFL radars for quite some time, not only with Morten Andersen, but also with our fellow NFL kickers, Tony Fritsch and Tony Lienert and Raimund Wersching. So we do go back, but we didn't really have skill position players, or in your case, linemen that our two countries produce. And then again, it always kind of takes the right team, the right coach. And that kind of brings me to a question that I was wondering about a lot. And I think, Bernard, that we even talked about on one of the previous instances of our podcast. And I want to direct this question to you, Hjalte, and you can correct me if I'm wrong with this, or if we are wrong with this impression, but is it the case that some coaches from the outside looking in seem to embrace international players more than others? I mean, we look at Ron Rivera and what he's done with Efeo Bada and letting German lineman David Bada debut last year in the regular season, or Bill Belichick, who drafted Sebastian Former, who got you into the organization, who got Jakob Johnson. Is it wrong to to say that those coaches are kind of trailblazers too for international players?
I mean, I think you can say so. I think that whenever I was a part of the draft process, it was really interesting to feel how much like, we know what you can do in the field, but like, who are you? That was such a big emphasis in the draft process. And I do believe that some coaches might see this in some international players that like, just like we, like generally not to suck us ourselves off, but we generally have our head screwed on, right? Because if we didn't, we wouldn't even be in this situation to begin with. Like we wouldn't have made it this far without just by luck generally. Like it's like we've pushed through the barrier. Like we've like, I am going to go out of my way and say goodbye to most things. Like everything that I expected to grow up with, like going to university, like living in an apartment with my brother, doing all these things. Like I'm deliberately making an effort to achieve this. And I think whenever they had all these questions about your character, I think that's something that they can see with international players, that they're like, these guys are going to get after it and they want it. So maybe even if someone like me, I honestly played well in college, but it took me a while to kind of get a groove of things in NFL. I think they could see what they see with European players is maybe they're not exactly there yet because they haven't had the exposure of competition and talent, but their ceiling is really high. So it's like, yeah, like you might be here right now, but we can take you to a really high level of playing football, because we know that you're going to give your best effort every single day. So I do believe some guys like that, whenever they're around international players, they're like, I'm not afraid of pulling the trigger on somebody that I do believe can have a positive outcome on my team.
Now, Bernard, you might correct me here again or not, but it seems that the international players amongst themselves have kind of created a bond, even maybe some kind of brotherhood, and you're talking to each other. And of course, when you look at other international players on different teams, is there talk amongst you players, which teams, which organizations, quote unquote, understand what they have at their hands with an international player? And I kind of, for myself, always bring up the example that Jakob Johnson on the Patriots, who of course have secured international marketing rights for the German markets, they knew how to sell him to a German audience. They knew how to get more exposure in Germany with a German player on their roster. Whereas if you look at him on the Raiders and what they're doing with him, it seems, again, from the outside looking in, and this is just me talking, that they've got no clue what gem of a person, what gem of a marketing opportunity they got at their hands. Is that something that did you talk about with other international players?
Not really. I'm not really talking about all the like marketing stuff. Sometimes we do. For example, like one guy's with the 49ers, Alfredo, and I don't know, it just felt like when we were going through the process and we knew what division it was, and then we didn't know which team picks what player, and then we weren't really surprised when the 49ers picked the Mexican player. And I think they're doing, as you said, a similar good job what the Patriots did with Jakob, of like sending him to places, and like, because it's really close to home and they have a huge fan base from Mexican people. And so I guess it's just like, if it fits what the team is trying to do, then they don't shy away of using that player. But as I said before, I would rather have them just see all the international players as players first, and don't really think about the marketing opportunity. Obviously, it's something they have to do because they want to make money too. But I would rather have them just see us as regular football players, just like everybody else, and not like have this stamp on you of like, hey, you are international, we can send you there because you are international. But I would rather have them just, okay, this is the football player, yes, he's from somewhere else, but you know, just have the market side on the side, I guess.
Yeah, I might kind of feel feel forced for some teams to put that stamp on certain players with international backgrounds. But then again, how much room for improvement is there? Because if you look at the international series and the NFL's international expansion, I mean, it really started once owners found out, oh, there's a shitload of money to be made because not that there's always going to be hunger for the NFL in North America. But I guess once owners found out how much money there's to be made with games in Germany and in London and next year, or actually this year in Sao Paulo, how much room do you think there is for international players to grow kind of into the system and in the system?
Yeah, I mean, I think Sagar had a good point. Like, of course, we want to be seen as players, but at the same time, I don't mind that they see a business opportunity, which gives 32 international players a professional opportunity. But I will say that, like, there might be some marketing to it, depending on what team you go to. But at the same time, I have a hard time thinking that Bill Belichick, like, signed Jakob or, like, agreed to get Jakob on the team because he has these from Germany. I really think he truly could not give any less of a fuck. Excuse my language, but he does not give a shit. Like, he's like, he probably saw a fullback. We like fullbacks. My fullback is getting a little old with Devlin. Maybe he can get it to work. Let's go. Like, that's and it just so happened that Patriot Deutschland or something, they're like, it's like Patriots is like the biggest fan base outside of US is like Germany. So that does help. But I don't know who picks it. I don't know if it's a GM that picks them or if it's like a media thing that picks them or points them wherever. But regardless whether or not it's a marketing investment, which is, you know, in essence, it's not like super cool. You want it because like, oh, because of the player, not have, oh, international stamp, whatever. This is a guy that would use it for some views. But still, I'm still happy with the fact that getting a chance to get some bunch of international players in here and kind of showing off to, you know, America's game because we can also play it.
And then again, it's still funny how certain fans or some fans and those who might be new to the sport adopt their team according to maybe a player who's already made his way into the league. See Jordan Mailata in Australia, see Amon-Ra St. Brown and the Detroit Lions now in Germany, and Jakob Johnson, of course, when he was with the Patriots. How is it in Denmark? And this might be an inexact science, but we just assume that now the Arizona Cardinals are the most popular team in Denmark just because of you. But is there maybe a Morten Andersen effect too, that a lot of Danish football fans grew up kind of watching him on the Saints and on the Chiefs and all those different teams? What's the American football fan landscape like in Denmark?
I definitely think there's become more Cardinals fans because of it. I don't know. I think like maybe like the way like I kind of grew up, I didn't ever really had a team. I just kind of adopted the Giants because the first game I watched was when they beat the Patriots in the Super Bowl as a kid. So I'm a Giants fan and I love Jeremy Shockey because he's crazy as hell. But I do believe that like they might more follow a guy and then like we become fans. They become fans of because it's kind of fun with like sports, especially internationally, is that like they almost, not in a bad way, not negative at all, but they like take possession of you. They're like, oh, he's our Danish player. So wherever Yalda is or wherever Psycho is, like that's because we love the team because of him. I'm sure there's a bunch of people that's bought some Frohold jerseys or wearing or are Cardinals fans now because of it. But if I do change teams, which I hope I don't, maybe they're going to change. I don't know. But I think it's just that the football enthusiasts are very excited about it that I'm over here. And then I think that media is using it to spread more awareness about, hey, there's a Danish guy. Watch this game. And even though, like, they have no clue. Like, if they're looking online, they're like, they can't point out. They don't know where I'm going. Like, it's not like a receiver. You're like, ooh, nice route. It's only like the football fanatic that can like see, watch the game, like, or we have a kicker and a center in the league, like ever Danish players in the league. It's not super exciting to watch, but you know, maybe eventually we'll get some skilled players. But I'm sure that there's definitely sparked some new, more Danish Arizona fans for sure.
Now, this conversation could be going on for several more hours, obviously, but your time's limited, Jelle, and Bernard has to go too. So I want to kind of round out this conversation about internationality in the NFL. And as we're recording this on New Year's Day, and a lot of people have come up with their New Year's resolutions, is there any New Year's resolution that you'd direct towards the National Football League in terms of ensuring, securing more internationality, more international players in the NFL? I mean, Bernard, you already alluded to it. Don't put a stamp on a player with a certain city of birth in his passport. Is it that simple?
No, I mean, I think that's on the player itself. Like, for example, Throw, like, he kind of made his way in the league. He was struggling at the start too, as he said. And I think if I would do the same, then the stamp, I mean, it never comes off. And I don't think you want it ever to come off, because you're kind of proud that you went that way and that you still made it. But like, it's on the player himself to like show that, like, I'm not just an international guy. So I don't think that's something that has to be changed. And I don't think it can be changed at all. But I think what I said earlier about like the NFL just spreading opportunities for young kids outside of the US, I think that's the most important thing, or that's something the NFL could do because they have the money to do it. I think that would be really great for the sport itself.
No, yeah, I don't know if it would make up a New Year's resolution, but you were talking about your struggles at very least in the early stages. Is there anything that could have helped you transition more easily into the National Football League as an American football professional? Anything that could have been done there, or anything that you now look back on where you say, well, this could have been easier?
Well, dude, I mean, I ended up getting a performance coach to help with my head and all the thoughts that are going on in my head. And I do believe, like, I think when you do come over here, you want everything to be perfect because you're like, it has to be perfect or else this is over. So whenever things didn't go my way, I went in a very negative route. And I think it's like, once I started being grateful and just happy for the opportunity to play football, and I just trust myself that what I can do is good enough, then I started enjoying it again, because that's how I got here to begin with. And then I started playing better because I'd stopped overthinking and I stopped trying to be perfect all the time. And I think that might be, at least from a European standpoint, from guys that I've met, it's like we can be very wound up in a way, and we want it to be freaking perfect all the time. Like, I talk to Jakob a lot, for example, and I don't know how it is in Austria, but, you know, the Germans are very much like, you gotta be fucking, like, there's one fucking way, man. And it's like, it's fucking straight ahead all the time. And I think that was hard for me to, you know, adjust to, because, like, I was not like exactly like Jakob, but I think that was one thing that I needed to adjust to, be like, hey, it's okay to make mistakes because everybody around you are also professionals. We're not in Europe anymore. Like, we can't just destroy the league because we're above average in Europe. It's okay to lose here and there. Like, you learn from it. I think that's one thing that if I could have had that in my head, my first 3 years, really two, 3 years, I could really have excelled even further, or at least excelled quicker, I guess. And then just have fun with it again. Cause I mean, that's the main part of it. Like, we all started the sport as a club team. On some club somewhere, just having fun and just, you know, tackling, learning to tackle, catch, block, doing everything. And then all of a sudden it's like, wow, now it's professional. Now I got to do all this and all that. It's like, no, just keep doing that same football. That's what helped me a lot.
I was watching the video closely, and there was a lot of nodding over on Bernard's screen and a lot of nodding that I did myself. So I guess truer words have seldomly been spoken, and this is the perfect way to round out this conversation. And thankfully enough, Ilde, you're sticking around for the last part, where we usually talk about some of the biggest news items of the week and things that happen around the NFL. So without further ado,
Rund um die NFL.
Around the NFL, the last parts on Winter Day Football O'Clock that we usually talk about. And as you're a guest or special guest analyst today on Winter Day Football O'Clock, Ilde, the first kind of question belongs to you. Outside of Arizona, and I guess in your mind it wasn't upsetting the Eagles, but outside of that Arizona Cardinals win, what was the biggest surprise when you looked at the scores in week 17? Something that made you go, wow, this really happened?
Well, I think, of course, there was a little controversial call with the whole Lions-Cowboys game. But other than, like, I mean, that's something we can discuss forever, whether or not they did this or that. But I think one of the most surprising things is just how Ravens are just tearing everybody up. And it's, like, not even funny how they're just destroying the top teams in the league. Like, they're just destroyed 49ers last week, who've been on the top for very long, like the number one contender. They killed the Dolphins, who silently are at an 11-4 record before that. And it's like, we played them too. We're like, that's a good team, man. They also killed the Browns once. And it's just like, it's just very impressive how they're just rolling. And like, I mean, hopefully it'd be fun to see them steamroll again through playoffs, obviously, if Lamar can keep that up, the defense can keep it up. But just killing the Dolphins 56-19 or something, that blew my mind.
And I think we can put the MVP discussion to rest, especially after everything that unfolded yesterday in that Baltimore and Miami game. Bernard, other way around, biggest disappointment of week 17 from kind of neutral perspective, is it the way the Eagles season seems to be going south?
No, I wouldn't say so. I mean, I don't know. I think they weren't a bad team or anything that we played yesterday. So I don't think it was like a huge disappointment or anything. I just think we just had a really good game. But it's funny that Fro picked the Ravens and the Dolphins as the surprise of week 17, because I would have picked the same one. And I think that's also a disappointment. Like, I thought the game was going to be way closer and the Dolphins were going to be able to just play with the Ravens and just hang in there more. But that it was so just, yeah. I saw a video and someone was like, yeah, in garbage time. And I was like, what garbage time? Ravens, Dolphins? So it's crazy. So I guess that's a disappointment.
And maybe disappointment being too strong a word. We'll think about word choice for our next episode. And to put a positive kind of, or get back to a positive approach, there are so many great stories unfolding every NFL season, and one of the best in recent memory just went into continuation this past Thursday with Joe Flacco leading the way, leading the Cleveland Browns to a playoff berth, becoming the only passer in 75-year plus history of the Cleveland Browns to record four straight 300-yard games. So that in itself is impressive. Jetta, I want to start with you again. What's the biggest story, again, neutral analyst, kind of neutral view of this NFL season? And where does Joe Flacco come in or rank in those greatest stories that you see as of right now?
Well, I mean, with the Browns, who have the superpower team that they had, and they absolutely, you know, embarrassed us when we went and played them. I mean, we all often, everybody had a bad game that day. Actually, defense did play pretty well. Offense had a bad game. But I mean, I think it's just, the transition from how, you know, that you have your superstar quarterback in Deshaun and then might not perform super well, but then he gets hurt and he's been in and out of, you know, he's been hurt and he gets back in and gets back out. And then they try around with a rookie quarterback and a couple of other guys. And then they found freaking Joe in the street. And then he's just coming in and just doing good old school playoff Joe Flacco, man. Like, I mean, I played against him last year with the Browns. He killed us when he was with the Jets. Like, they're behind like 16 points with a minute 50 left and they won. It was unbelievable. But, you know, I think – I don't really know if there's anything that tops that. I think Joe Flacco just doing his Joe Flacco things, and then it's just wild. And then him going into the playoffs in a super high note, like I kind of want to see – it's good for the league to get a really good quarterback back in, because, I mean, we kind of lost Aaron Rodgers early in the season, and it always sucks because, like, the season would be fun with Aaron Rodgers. It would really stir shit up. So it's nice that Joe came in and just, like, took the Browns from being, like – kind of on a downer, like, okay, they're actually going to miss even with all this talent. And then Joe just like takes them off, man. That's awesome. That's awesome to see.
And let's not get too far ahead of ourselves, but we might be getting playoff games where Joe Flacco plays with the Browns at Baltimore. And we might be getting Jared Goff hosting a playoff game with the Detroit Lions against the LA Rams and Matthew Stafford. So that might happen. But Bernard, biggest story for you so far, or biggest individual story so far this year in the NFL?
Yeah, I think Joe, obviously, that's just, I mean, it's just refreshing to watch, like, someone coming in and then you don't expect him to do good, and then all of a sudden he's like the star within 1-2 weeks. And also, like there was a video I saw, like, him on the sideline, and he's like almost falling asleep, and someone was like, well, if you have five kids, or I think he has five, and he was like, if you have five kids, you take every second you get to rest. So I don't know, it's just funny that he's playing so good, and I'm happy. But for me, maybe it's because I'm a tight end, but I think Sam Laporta is also a really great story this season, just the way he came in. And just, you know, you always expect rookies to have like growing pain and stuff like that. Even like premier rookies, like where you think they should be able to play right away. But he just came in and he showed that he belongs here and has a really good season. So I think he's also another guy that's that I've enjoyed watching.
And of course, Sam Laporta plays on Detroit, or for Detroit, and this Detroit squad has been in the news quite a bit for something that happened during their game against the Cowboys, and that essentially cost them a W that they could have needed in maybe even securing the number two spot or the number one seed in the NFL that now belongs to the San Francisco 49ers. I don't want to talk about what happened in Dallas in terms of officiating specifically, but more from a general viewpoint. Does officiating here in the NFL need fixing or improvements?
It's such a hard question to answer, because
it is loaded indeed. Yeah.
I'm not an NFL ref, but I did like very limited refereeing just back in Denmark. And it's like, I know it was at a super, I mean, it was just a small school, like it was young kids, whatever, but it's like, there is such thing as human error. And we do hold them to an extremely high standard sometimes, because the stakes are so high. So obviously when they blow a call the last seconds of the game, where like, apparently, like, it sounded like Coach Campbell went up to a ref and said, like, they go through this before the game. They probably went up and said, Decker's going to report. Skipper's going to go over there just to talk, so it looks different. But and Decker's going to just do this. He's not going to do your original report. You know, it's just going to be a quick one. Talk to him before the game. Talk to him what it was going to be. And he's, because he said it multiple times, I fucking talked to you about it. Like, I told you. And that's like, you know, we expect them to do perfect, but whenever those calls come out and it's like, I hate to see it that like a ref ends up changing the impact, like the whole impact of a game. But at the same time, I also have a little bit of like, because the same thing happens to us as players, you know, like we're not perfect. There's human error. We make errors and people also hail us for it. So it's like, it's hard as a ref, but I mean, there's some things with centers now with like our snap count that they're going to change. Like in silent cadence, I've got 5 flags this year because my silent cadence is off or too fast or something like that, which has never been an issue. They just decided to change that mid-season. Like by week 6, they're like, let's do this. No precautionary, didn't tell anybody, just kind of did it. And I'm like, I've been doing this for years. Everybody's been doing it for years. All of a sudden, you just want to change it? Like, what the hell? So I think some of those, like we're in meetings too, and it's like you can see throughout the season that they're trying to ramp up on certain calls or trying to ramp down on certain calls. But it's like, why is there such a differentiate? Like, why is that flowing through a season? It's like, oh, we're calling too many DPIs. Let's get them down. Or, oh, there's too many defensive false starts because they can't just look at the ball. Let's tack the centers. I'm like, why are we doing that during the season? Like, get your orders in check. And then the unfortunate calls, as if he doesn't see the report or whatever, that sucks. That's human error. But like all the small stuff that you see, you're like, what constitutes a holding now? What constitutes a DPI? What constitutes a false start? It's just, I feel like there's a little bit too much nuance in it. And they're trying to protect the game or whatever. I don't know, but there's a little, sometimes you just feel like they're taking over a game.
And I know it's a dicey proposition for active NFL players to talk about officiating, but when I look at it, it always kind of sends shivers down my spine when I hear the word emphasis. There's a new emphasis on this and there's a new emphasis on that. And when I'm watching football and you as an offensive lineman, you can correct me better than anyone else. If you as a referee were to be looking for a holding on a play, wouldn't you find one on every play if you really wanted to look very hard for one?
I mean, 100%. Like, but it's just that changes from crew to crew. Like this past week, they called like no holdings. And I'm like, they could probably pull me for one there, or they should probably have got him for one there. Like they only call the egregious ones. So like you got to know which crew you go into, but it's also like, why is there so much nuance to crew? Like, why is this crew doing it in a certain way? Or it's like, oh, this crew is old school. They do this, or oh, this crew is new school. So they call it by the book. This crew is very mellow. They don't call a lot. They let the players play. And it's just like, it's just kind of funky how, you know, that, you know, there's just not a lot of, like, it just changes a lot from week to week. And, but yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's just, it's hard to answer, really. I don't know really how to answer perfectly or give you like a clear cut answer, especially in those things.
So the one play that always comes to mind, and you as a Giants fan, you can probably relate to it. The one Super Bowl, the first Super Bowl that the Giants won against the Patriots, that play where Eli just heaved it up and Tyree came down with the ball on his helmet. You kind of start counting the different offensive holdings and you end up at four or five on that single play. It just weren't called because it's a Super Bowl and you don't want to ruin the Super Bowl with calling penalties, apparently. So there's that. But Bernard, you as someone who follows the league as closely as it gets, is there, what would you try to fix when it comes to officiating, or try to do differently?
I think Fro said it best when he said it's like there is human error, but as long as they don't take over the game or change the outcome of the game, I think that's what they have to strive for. Because like everybody understands that, well, like let's say I get a holding call and obviously I'm going to say no, I didn't hold the guy. So there's always this, like, that one team is always going to complain about the ref if they get the calls. So I think that's never going to change, and I think that's just how sport is. But when it comes to decisions that just literally changes the outcome of the game. I think they have to be better on that. I don't know how to solve it, but I think it's like in some cases it's just more let the players play, and if it gets outrageous, then call it. But like if you change the outcome of the game, that's not what it's supposed to be. And it's supposed to be about the players on the field battling it out and not the refs saying, hey, this was so wrong, and now the outcome is changed.
I know there's no one size fits all solution, but my approach would be make everything and anything reviewable. You still have your two challenges, but maybe that'd be a step into the right direction. I know it's a loaded topic, and I don't want to lead you onto slippery surface right here, or even more than I already did. So we're gonna go to Yellow's kind of backyard, front yard, something right down your alley. And this corresponds with something that I started a couple weeks ago when I had international player pathway program athlete Max Pircher from Italy here on the show. He's currently on the Detroit Lions practice squad, so he can probably relate to that officiating discussion too. But I made him kind of rank his best offensive tackles. And of course, he came up with Pede and Taylor Decker. He basically had to, but with you not being in discussion right there because you're the best sentiment anyways, Yelda. But who are the best centers in the NFL not named Yelda Ford? Everybody keeps talking about Jason Kelce. Is he still the gold standard? And if not, even if he is, who else is there? Who are like the top three, the top five center that immediately come to mind?
Well, I mean, I still believe that Jason Kelce is, you know, one of the top dogs. Obviously, he's a 14-year vet, and obviously a lot of people who've seen his documentary, he's dealing with a lot of stuff and pain and all that's, you know, what comes of being in the league just in general, but especially as an offensive lineman for that long. I think he's always in that GOAT conversation, but I mean, he's had in a row, how he's played, how he's been kind of moving this team in the direction that they're at now. But outside of Jason, like my really good friend, so maybe I'm a little biased, but Frank Ragnow for the Lions is an absolute animal. Hopefully he doesn't hear this podcast because I don't want him to hear me suck him off, but he's a really good player, man. And he's just consistent. He does the same set, the same thing over and over. And I make fun of him about it, but he's like, but it works. So he just does. I call him double under king. That's all he does. He just catches it, gets double unders, and then he just squeezes because he got this like absurd strength in his forearms. So he just squeezes you. And the second he has his hands on you, you're done. And it's just, there's nothing else to be done. Outside of him, one guy I really enjoyed watching is Brendel from the Niners. Same guy, kind of not in the same boat that I was in, but bounced around a little bit, haven't really been playing a lot. And then all of a sudden he got a chance to go in and he's balled out. And I think he's very active with his hands, especially in that 49er system where they change up their sets a lot. They do a lot of different things on the offensive line. I think Brendel is up there, I think, in my conversation as one of the more premier centers. And I mean, yeah, there's a lot of other dudes too. And I'm losing all their names now just thinking about them. I do like Mitch Morse from Buffalo. He's very big in his kick, but he's really good at redirecting. So I like watching him play. I talked to him a little bit, but I forget his name. Tyler, the center. Damn it. Biadasz for the Cowboys.
Biadasz, yeah. I struggled with the name too.
Yeah. I think he's also done a really good job. You know, he's a little undersized coming in, and he's, you know, kind of just taking over that offensive line, and he definitely leads it. And that's one thing you can see him doing. And then he plays a really good game. You know, he changes his setup a little bit too, and he has a lot of big boys in his league. A lot of good D linemen in his division to play against. We play against this year. It's a mess. And he's also performed whenever he has to. So I think that's some of my guys right now that I can just think of right off the top of my head. But they're definitely Frank, Kelce, and Brendel might be my top three right now.
And you haven't mentioned Brandon's first name. It's, of course, Jake Brendel. And that just shows to people out there, give a little more love to the centers of the league. And next time you watch an American football game, maybe closer than you'd like to, watch the center and watch what he's doing before the play, during the play, after the play. It's a sight to behold indeed when looking at those people who are indeed, no pun intended, center of attention, hopefully for some listeners out there. To round this one out, and I've taken way more time out of your time kind of budget than I should have, so I'm really glad that you're doing this. But Bernard, with only 1 week of regular season football action left, how much sadness is there, or how much are you looking forward for the season to be over? What's the feeling like right now for you and as far as you can tell within the Cardinals organization?
For me personally, it's always a long season, and even before the season, training camp, OTAs, everything. So whenever it comes to the end of the season, it's like, damn, like it goes by so fast that you forget about all the time where you were like, because early in the season, you're like, sheesh, week three, you know, and it's going to take so long and whatever. And then by the end of the year, it's like, whew, it went past quick. So I don't know. That's just how I feel. I don't know. I'm excited for the last week. And then we'll see, attack the off season and stuff. But it's been a long season, so I think everybody's kind of ready to take 1 or 2 weeks off and just clear the mind again too. So yeah, but it goes by quick.
Yeah, you're approaching the end of your fifth year in the league. How do you feel heading into this last home game against Seattle?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's always hard whenever you know that the end is near, I think, because in the beginning of the season, like Zach said, you kind of just bang your head against the wall. Like, you're just having your head down, you're doing what you need to do because you just finished camp. You're like, you got 3 days off, and then you're heading into week one, and then you're just going. And then I always feel like the closer I get to the end, when I'm like 4 or 5 weeks out, I just always start to like think like, shit, it's actually pretty awesome what we do and what we get to do and the relationships that we have. Like, I, even though we've lost a lot, which sucks, I don't think I've laughed more than I have this year. Like, I've had a really good time with everybody. I mean, Psycho and Seven, like, for example, Psycho, this tight end grandfather, Jeff Swain, he's awesome. Like, just meeting new people that, like, you never think that, like, you always think that, okay, I have my friends, and, like, I don't know people anymore. But then, like, I met a new fellow international player, and I'm like, that's freaking awesome. And then I met new O-line dudes that I've never had before, that I walked into offseason, like, I don't know if I'm going to have a relationship with these guys. And then at the end of the season, you've gone through all this BS, and you're like, wow, everything is so fun right now. Like, it's cool. Like, of course, we're not winning. We just won, which is great. But then you just know in a week's time, everything's just going to kind of, this group is done, which I get a little sad about, because my first couple of years, I was just looking forward to the offseason because I was like, I need to get the hell out of here. But I think the more I've been in it, the more I'm like trying to cherish last moments I have, because of course I'm going to enjoy time with my daughter and my wife finally, and travel and stuff. But it's definitely going to be hard as well to say goodbye.
And you just mentioned it. You just became a father a couple of months ago, and please do enjoy the time that you have with your family. But when's the first trip to Austria going to take place?
The first trip to Austria? Oh, we already got a plane. We're going to summer. Boom.
Perfect. Let's just make sure that Bernard's mom or Bernard's friends are hosting you and giving you a proper reception.
Oh yeah, for sure. No, we'll crash their house, 100%.
The red carpet.
Of course, red carpet treatment, nothing else.
Oh, yeah.
Hey,
I love it.
Listen, thank you so much for jumping onto the show. Maybe you are indeed the the lucky charm, or we are the lucky charm for the Arizona Cardinals. Let's find out next week. Let's do this again. Thank you so much, Yalda, and thank you so much, Bernhard, for doing this. Happy New Year to both of you and your families. Looking forward to talking to you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Happy New Year, and it's always fun to chat a little bit football. Appreciate you guys.
Yeah, thanks. Football.
He's at the 30. He's at the 20. He won't give it up. Oh, he's got the first time. 2 seconds.